Well, good evening to all the Mets fans out there. This is Rich Sparago, known on Twitter as CT Mets Fan, and you are listening to the Metsian podcast on, you know, we have to call this a happy day, right? I mean, let's face it. The tri-state area of the world, but mostly the tri-state area, is reopening. We're going to talk about the increased capacity at Citi Field. But more importantly than any of that, from a baseball perspective, the Mets are winning. And it's always much more fun to talk Mets baseball when the team is doing well, as they certainly are. So with no further ado, it's time to start talking Mets baseball. And to help me out with that, I'd like to bring on my two co-conspirators in podcasting. First, we'll start in Brooklyn and bring on Mr. Mike LeCollin. So, Mike, how are you, and how are things in Brooklyn tonight?
I'm doing well. Things are going as well as can be expected here in the Borough of Kings. And, you know, chugging right along. Looking forward to talking Mets baseball.
Awesome. And the next gentleman I'll bring on is, you know, has many titles, you know, Grand Poobah Podcasting Operations, CEO, all those various titles and monikers. And I always ask him the same question when I'm hosting. So, Mr. Sam Maxwell, how are you and where are you tonight?
Tonight, I'm doing well. Thank you for asking, Rich. Hello, Mike, and hello out there to all. I am in the city tonight, and as most people within the boroughs refer to it, is specifically Manhattan is the city. To other people outside of New York City itself and the surrounding areas is the city, but within the five boroughs, it all gets focused on Manhattan as the city.
Very nice. And if I may ask for a tad bit more specificity, are you down in like the Meatpacking District or what part of Manhattan tonight?
Health Kitchen, be exact.
Health Kitchen, there you go. Very nice, very nice. All right, well, thank you, Sam. Thank you, Mike. And as we know, the Mets are going to be playing a game in about an hour and 6 minutes by my clock. So it's time to get started talking so we can have this done before the first pitch. And so let's talk about some of the goings-on on the field of late. And so I'm going to start with this, and I'll throw it to you, Mike, first. And the first question here is, on June 3rd, it's just bizarre. I mean, the Mets have had 17 guys on the injured list at various points, most of whom are starters. Then they lost basically their second line. So in the old days of, you know, when you're playing kids sports, they're basically on their third string, or were on their third string, if you use a term. And yet they win, yet they find themselves at the moment four games ahead of the Braves, who won this afternoon. So they're in first place. They're playing with replacements. I don't know how in the world they're doing it. So, Mike, what are your thoughts as we look at the standings on June 3rd, look at the decimated Mets and find them atop the National League East?
Who are these guys, right? You know, as the condition worsens, your expectations come down. We know we came into the seasons with rather high expectations. But, you know, who are these guys? Sometimes it's like watching the St. Louis Wolves. Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know who's on third. It's been that kind of a season thus far. But it's been fun. It's been fun. You know, the grit, watching them battle adversity and being in first place. And as Sam says, surprisingly, the Mets have the biggest first place lead in baseball. I did not realize that until he stated that in the show's write-up. They're still feeding off of that seven-game win streak, and more currently, you know, they're winners of six of their last seven. April, you know how I feel about April and May, Rich. April, 9-11, but in May, 17-9. You know, and now we're entering June, and they put themselves in a good spot with everything going wrong. There's still six games over 500. And let's put this into context. The rest of the division is under 500. And there's six teams outside of the NL East that have more wins than the Mets. And I'll throw this last tidbit out there. One of those six teams, One of six National League teams have a plus run differential, and the Mets are one of them. And that's an odd way to be situated into first place. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, the Mets are one of six teams to have a positive run differential. Meanwhile, there's 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, there's other teams that are above 500 who don't have a positive run differential. So let me get off that one.
Just to say,
that's how it starts.
It's heavy in the AL East and it's heavy in the NL West.
Yeah. But, yeah, let me get off that point and finish there. You know, I'm just getting ahead of myself. But a lot of interesting things going on. You know, Pasco collect you $200.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of interesting stuff. So, Sam, I'll ask you the same question about how you feel about the Mets. And, you know, what is it real for you? But before I do, you know, I want to give a little context. I do one of the things I do is I write for Mesmerized Online, and I do the series previews. And so I'm going to read a couple of numbers to you just to kind of lead you in here. When it comes to offensive statistics, I'll just read off a couple. The Mets have the 16th highest team batting average in baseball at .234. They have the 23rd highest OPS at .678. So you know what I'm saying. The offense is you know, we'll call it pedestrian to be kind. But then we look at pitching. The Mets starters ERA is first in Major League Baseball at 2.94. Their team ERA is second in baseball at 3.17. So it's pretty clear how they're doing it. But I'll ask you the same question I asked. How do you feel finding the Mets in first place, and how the heck are they in first place?
Well, for one thing, let me just read some names off, and you guys tell me whether it's the 2009 Mets or the 2021 Mets. So let's start with Corey Sullivan, and then I'll go to Brandon Drury, and then let's go off to Nick Evans and go back over to Billy McKinney. What's interesting to me is that these are some names that we would have been like basically chastising the Wilpons for, and that certainly the verdict was out as to what was going to happen with the new regime during this time of crisis. And I think one of the things that we are seeing, and somebody was saying that I needed to give Louis Rojas more credit and less to Steve Cohen and to the new aura around the team right now. But I do think that it needs to be stated, and it probably goes all the way back to before the injuries with Patrick Mazika getting so many big hits, or really not even hits, but fielder's choice just making contact, which is not even a something that is done much these days. It's all strikeouts or home runs. So lately, the Mets have been making contact with contact as needed. And like you said, I think you said something about them being 23rd in OPS, which means that they're also doing it without much power. They are making proper contact. And even if you look at the hit Pete got the other day, he didn't try to do too much. He went with the pitch that was down and just got that run in, just got Francisco Lindor, who had made it to third in. You know, we're going to have to see whether they continue to get these types of performances, and or whether the book comes in terms of the scouting for the other teams. But right now, everybody's not trying to do too much. They're just doing exactly what they need to. Brandon Drury has some power. McKinney has some power. All of them are making some sick defensive plays out there. Everybody who's inserted gets their job done, whether it's defensively or offensively. And you know, basically, players like Kevin Pillar and Jonathan Villar are two types of players that I don't see. I see that just being as they finally get to the Mets and they completely collapse their careers during the Wilpon era. But the complete opposite is happening, where they're revitalizing their careers and, in fact, basically doing somewhat to what Bartolo Colon did, which is take their career to new heights in terms of that
that folklore, that that folk hero type. You know, we can explore a little bit more about that specifically in terms of what Kevin Pillar is doing right now. So yeah, you know, that's basically how they're doing it. The narrative has changed. They're shaking some of those kinks off a little bit, and we can talk about some of, you know, it's, you know, we got to be Debbie Downer in some areas, but I think a lot of it, you are seeing these little subtle details of the new regime, of new ownership, and you're seeing basically that toxicity just starting to just shed like a lizard shedding its skin right before our eyes.
You know, that's the interesting thing that you just said at the end there about how it just seems like the toxicity is gone, seems like the activity is gone, and you're right. You know, everybody's making the analogy from 2009 to 2021, and in 2009 they just absolutely, you know, they're awful. They had the same amount of injuries or similar amount. But in 2021, they've weathered the storm. They're playing with, you know, replacements, but yet somehow there's some different aura that's making these guys competitive where the 2009 team wasn't. So I want to talk about Kevin Pillar in particular. You mentioned him, Sam, so we'll start with you on this one. What about this guy? I mean, that was the most gruesome sports injury, other than when LT sacked Joe Theismann, which was, that was probably the second most disgusting sports injury I've ever seen. The way the blood was pouring out of his nose like a faucet, it was just unbelievable. And the guy is playing. Now, so what are your thoughts on Pillar? And then second to that, is it only me? I get squeamish every time he's in the box. I look away. I don't want to see him his entire at bat, because if this guy gets hit again, I can't even fathom the thought. So what are your thoughts on Pillar? Is it heroic? What are you thinking about that?
Well, I think the complete story has yet to be written. I think, weirdly enough, I mean, you see the look on his eyes now, especially I don't think he has the mask when he's batting, because it probably inhibits his vision a little bit, but when he is on the bases and when he's in the outfield, he does have it. We haven't seen him completely tested in the outfield. I think we're going to need to, in terms of, you know, because that's a big part of his game, is just how, you know, he's Superman, as they call it, right? So I think, for one thing, specifically with the hitting right now, the way he's hit since he came back, he may be on another level. This may have taken his focus, weirdly enough, to the next level. He doesn't look squeamish. He doesn't look frightened. He looks arguably more focused than ever. And the hitting has always been behind his defense from the get-go. But he has been serviceable at certain points. And I'd like to actually pull up his numbers, because I've never really given it a complete look. But I do remember when he first came aboard with the Blue Jays, everybody was just talking about this. Like, within, I think, the first, like, 2 to 3 weeks, he had, like, 10 different leaping catches that everybody thought were the greatest catches of all time. At the beginning there, he batted .206, but then he started becoming a little bit more serviceable, and it looks like the highest that he's ever batted was actually in 2020 with .288, but other than, you know, for a full season, it was .278 in 2015. So he's 32 years old, not to say that, you know, he's basically right now in his prime, that, you know, not to say that he's going to become a better hitter, but, you know, it may bring his focus to another level in some odd, twisted circumstances of fate. And one of the things that, you know, I heard other people, as well as I think he might have mentioned it, that the way it did hit him, even though it was gruesome to say the least, had it just been just a few inches to, I forget exactly where it was, but, it, you know, basically it would have hit him right in the head. And who knows exactly what would have happened. So, like, that's really something, weirdly enough, that, like, breaking his nose might have saved his life.
I've heard that, you know, that if it hit him in the cheek,
he would have shattered his cheekbone. I mean, there's no question. It would have absolutely shattered his cheek. And, the nose obviously has a couple of bones in it that he was able to have surgically repaired. But if you shatter a cheek, and then everybody, people from a different era talk about Tony Cagliari, who got hit in the eye and was out for years, got his vision back, tried to make a comeback, didn't really succeed. And then he passed away at a very, very young age. And obviously all that stuff, Mike, went through my mind when I saw Pilar get hit. And now that he's back, having had nasal surgery a week and a half ago, and the man is out there playing and he's all that with the thing on the nose when he's in the field and on the bases and the C flap when he's at bat. I mean, what do you think about when you see that?
Met fans our age, Rich, can probably remember something similar happening to Mike Jorgensen. But I remember Kirby Puckett. I remember Giancarlo Stanton more recently. And the thing is, Kevin Pillar said that this wasn't the first time he's gotten hit in the face before. But I think this is a classic demonstration in professionalism. He's a veteran. And experience is the best teacher. And, after a bunch of years in the major leagues, he knows how to conduct himself and how to handle himself and how to set an example and how his actions will rub off and perhaps influence other individuals. The main point of this is this clubhouse is so unified, that him returning just to be on the scene when other scenarios, other teams, other sports, you don't see this person for a while. But here he is in the clubhouse wanting to be a part of it, and it seems like everybody embraces that and everybody embraces each other. And that's, partly what's going on with this, let's say, successful team to date. But, Pilar, you need to be a strong-minded individual to continue forward the way he has. Again, not the first time that it happened to him. He told us that, I believe, a day or 2 days after the incident happened. So a lot of respect, that takes a lot of will to do, a lot of commitment and want to go forward. So kudos to him.
So let's stick with that. And I'll stick with you, Mike, on this, and then I'll go to Sam. So you talked about Pilar and what it means to see that, where the guy got very seriously hurt. He's right back out there, team first kind of a thing. I was too young for this, but you see the stories about Willis Reed in, I think it was 1969 or 1970, whatever year it was that the Knicks won the world championship of basketball, where he was incredibly hurt and he hobbled onto the court for game 7 against the Lakers. And the people who were on the team, DeBuscher, Frazier, all those guys, they say that seeing him out there inspired them to go out there and win the championship and beat the Lakers in that game. So there's a bit of that with Pilar, I think, where, like you were saying, they see the dedication, they see team first, and it definitely rubs off. But here's where I want to go with this, Mike. I've never been a big Luis Rojas fan. I have seen him as a guy who's very smart, probably a guy who belongs in the front office, crunching numbers, using advanced statistics and all that kind of thing. I didn't see him as a good manager. He just doesn't seem to be dynamic. It never seemed to me that he had a good feel for the game, like not having relievers warming up. And sometimes it seemed like the game was two steps ahead of him. But you have to give this guy credit. They're in first place. They play hard for him. He's been able to, keep the thing together. So my question to you is, do you think this has been sort of Luis Rojas's baptism, where he's had to go through adversity? Yes, he's had the help of Pilar being the example, but he's really risen to the occasion. I see a different guy in the past couple of weeks. I see a different guy in the postgame. He seems more confident. His head is up instead of down. I don't know. Am I crazy? Are you seeing it too, Mike?
No, I see it. You got to consider – you got to isolate last season for what it was. Everybody was in isolation with all the Zoom conferences, with the press and the presses, this, that, and the other. This year, same circumstance somewhat, but a little bit more intense. a little bit more frequent, but he's growing with the job. He's growing into this position. He's growing as a manager. Let's not forget, he has still yet to manage 162 games. But throughout, you know, his time as manager so far, he's proven to be very stoic. He doesn't get high. He doesn't get low. He's very level-headed. But this is, after all, on-the-job training. So, you know, we have to keep an open mind and be a little bit forgiving sometimes. You're right. He proved himself unprepared in certain situations where he should have had people warming up in the bullpen, as you say, Rich. But he seems to be improving on that. Although I agree with you 100% on that. He was behind in that respect. But the players like him, and the players are behind him. And you know, gaining their attention and their respect is half the battle. Let's not forget that Rojas comes from good baseball DNA, family behind him, good life experience behind him. The world of baseball is as natural to him as, you know, a parrot in the Amazon jungle. You know, it's his home. Baseball is his home. So nothing's going to take him by surprise. He's probably seen it all at one level or another. Something that we need to understand is where he doesn't necessarily suffer a language barrier, sometimes we need to be a little bit forgiving in the delivery. Because when English is not your native language, sometimes you have to process and think a second, think of something in Spanish and then translate it into English, and then what comes out, you know, comes out and it speaks for itself. I would appreciate if the media could be a little bit more lenient in that respect. Papers 100 years ago, and not even that long ago, Rich, we can go back to Roberto Clemente and many other ball players that they would quote them exactly the way words, letters, and pronunciation came out of their mouths, and that was wholly unfair, talking about somebody who can communicate to people in two different languages versus one, and the person with one claims to be the authority in that process. So I'm getting off of my soapbox now. But, you know, give Luis Rojas some leniency, some patience. He's learning on the job. This is on-the-job training. Let's not forget that this was not Sandy Alderson's hire. And let him evolve, and let's evaluate him after this season. And, you know, if they decide to stay with him, we must reevaluate him if and when players, managers, and the media are allowed in the same room again. Right now, everything's different, and we're applying the same standards to a very unique and uncommon condition.
Fair enough. Good point on the native language thing, because, you know, I always, when I see people say, well, why isn't he conducting the, you know, interview in English? I mean, seriously, I can't speak two languages. If someone asked me, you know, I had 15 years of French, I think, from sixth grade right through college. And if I was in France and somebody asked me a question in French, I would not want to be on TV trying to answer that question in French. I would ask for it to be translated English. I give these guys nothing but credit for trying. Did you see Ronald Acuna the other night? I think it might have been Tuesday night. For the first time, he answered a question in English. It was posed to answer a question, asked for that because he's been studying English. This guy is not only maybe the players in Major League Baseball, he's simultaneously learning a second language and now is willing to conduct an interview in that second language. I can't do any of that. I can't do anything he's doing right now. So, I mean, I admire the guy for everything he's doing.
If I may, Rich, you're seeing the process of the academies in the islands work. You see Latin players coming to America much more prepared. Look at Lindor. Look at Correa from Houston. As you say, Acuna. They're more prepared than players were, say, 40 years ago to come to the United States and deal with the American media. You know, forever Pittsburgh wanted to call Roberto Clemente Bobby, and he didn't appreciate that. And that was them trying to force that upon him in the press. And he's like, my name's not Bobby. My name's Roberto. You know what I mean?
I do. No, I totally do. So, Sam, let's get you in on Luis Rojas. Is the man coming of age before your eyes? What are you seeing? And do you think the whole gelling of the team, whether it's Ron Pilar or whatever reason, is just helping Luis Rojas grow before our eyes? What are you seeing?
Well, I just need to first say that I dropped out of Italian after taking all of it in high school, but once I got to college and half of it was orally speaking in terms of the test, I would ace the written part, and then they would ask me a question orally, and I wouldn't be – I'd be like, I can't. I'm sorry. I have to move on. Via. But anyway, going back to what you said about how much more confident Louis looks, I go back to one of the games that got rained out. And, I think it might have had something to do with the Marlins, but, like, they still didn't completely have their footing at the time. And there was some news, and I'm going to have to, like, go back into the schedule. But the Mets got rained down, and they always taunted the manager right after the rain out to talk about some stuff. And Louis, he just looked so depressed sitting there with the rain out and some other stuff. I forget exactly when it was, but absolutely. He's settling in. They like playing for him, and what else can I say that hasn't been said about it? It was just that one specific game that that contrasts in my mind with what we're seeing now with what we saw then, and especially in 2020.
Well, and I think I've just seen him mature. So I use the word mature loosely. I've seen him come of age in the role. I think everything you both have said is true. You know, Mike was saying that, he's growing on the job, which he is. And, you know, to the people who said you can't judge somebody off the 60-game season, I at first poo-pooed that, but now I'm kind of seeing that myself. Because now he's going through all the stuff that happens. Yes, it's been exacerbated with the Mets, and the injuries are off the charts, but in a typical season, you're going to go up, you're going to go down, you're going to back up, you're going to go back down. This guy's going to do that, that guy's going to do that. You know, and he's going through the stuff that you go through as a baseball manager, and he's handling it well. I mean, he's impressing me, and I have to say I was not a fan. I'm becoming one. So, all right. That's
Can I throw it out there that I think the Marlins game got suspended on the 11th, and then the next day, the Phillies on the 12th of April, they had to postpone that game too. And I think everything felt really glum there. And when they interviewed him, you could kind of see that on his face with both him and the entire franchise. But hey, you know, what a difference a month and a half makes.
True. And if you think about it, the last game they played on April 10th, that was the game where DeGrom got beat by the Marlins, where Jazz Chisholm hit a home run off of them. And so they had lost the game. Then they were rained out Sunday, rained out Monday. And it just was kind of a glum time. They were coming off of just a week before, 10 days before, the series in Washington had been canceled. So, yeah, definitely. So you're listening to
the And also they then went on to sweep the Phillies in what became a three-game series that also had another game postponed on the 15th.
Yes. Exactly. So you're listening to the Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and we're glad that you're spending some of your time with us. So now let's go to the injuries. It's hard to talk about the Mets, not talk about the injuries. So let's talk about some of the more critical ones. So, yes, we've talked about this. They're playing well. They're fun to watch. They're somehow in first place. It's great. Luis Rojas is growing into the job. All of that, that's great. But let's talk about some other stuff. June is going to be a rough month for this team. Padres coming up in 40 minutes, and then, you know, four games in San Diego, then three more next week in at City Field. three doubleheaders before the end of the month. They will see the Braves again before the end of the month. A lot of tough competition. This will clearly be the toughest month they've had. With that said, we will not see Michael Conforto or Jeff McNeil. If we see them before the 4th of July, it's a miracle. I'm going to say 4th of July, maybe even after the All-Star break. So here's where I'm going with this, Sam. I'll start with you. They're riding it. It's great. But the tide's about to turn. Competition's getting more stiff. You're going to be using these guys over a longer period of time. And we all know if you use guys, they get exposed. So you're going to be using these replacements. My question to you is, with stiffer competition, the replacements being out there even more, chance to get more exposed, do you think that there are storm clouds on the horizon for this team, or do you think they can hold on?
Well, I mean, it's a good question, but I think they've been shuffling the chess pieces around. And, of course, these are human beings, so, you know, one of the issues has always been thinking about these guys as only chess. But I think right now everything does seem to be moving properly into place. You know, I think what really is the saving grace is the pitching. That regardless, it seems as if, you know, it's not like these guys have come in and been Babe Ruth. Like, you see right now that you know, people like Familia are basically keeping this team in the game. You know, Miguel Castro. And of course, Edwin Diaz, unfortunately, he blew a save the other day, but luckily he didn't get the loss, even if we got the loss later a little bit controversially. So I see storm clouds on the horizon, other than the fact that it does seem to be going to be raining a lot over the next 2 days in New York City, not literally. Yes, I think that they're going to have to be careful and make sure that they do keep shuffling around properly once they see something getting exposed. You know, hopefully at that point, you know, we're talking about like going back to 2009, you know, we're waiting for the cavalry to storm back. But, you know, I don't really expect – I mean, like, is it really going to be or is Michael Conforto really going to be out? He was just taking – apparently he was not using his legs much, but he was just taking batting practice out in San Diego. So who knows what exactly is on the horizon. But I think this is going to be a real test for the Mets. But I do think that they can handle it because right now they have shown me nothing otherwise. And I'm going to keep believing in them because, you know, like the old saying goes, Rich, you got to believe.
Pretty cool. Mike, I'm going to throw a couple of names at you, a couple of them said already. So McNeil and Conforto, let's face it, hamstrings, when anything other than a very mild hamstring pull, you're looking at 6 to 8 weeks, and they went down on May 16th it was. So 6 to 8 weeks brings you to early July, maybe the All-Star break. So same timeline for McNeil and Conforto. Hey, if they're back earlier, that's great, but you have to think that's going to be their timeline. Couple other things. Brandon Nimmo, nerve issue in the finger. They have no idea when this guy's ever, you know, or shouldn't say ever, but they have no idea when this guy's going to start swinging the bat again. JD Davis was shut down. He's not going to play any more games until his hand is pain-free. We're not talking about minor parts here, Mike. We're talking about Conforto, McNeil, all-stars. JD Davis, hard-hitting third baseman. Brandon Nimmo, leadoff hitter with a 400 OBP. That's a lot of talent not coming back in the near future. My question to you is, Mike, same one, can they hold the line here, or do you think the jig might be up for the replace Mets?
One might think it's a flip of a coin. You know, the onus is going to be on Lindor. The onus is going to be on Dominic Smith and Pete Alonso. And James McCann is stepping up. We know that's not going to last, but, you know, if he can find an agreeable mean, we'll be okay. Yeah, Rich, those are prominent names. Nimmo, Conforto, McNeil, you know, Syndergaard is pushed back, Carrasco's pushed back. We were expecting them late summer. We're not going to get that. So here we are. We're in a situation where we know what we're going to have, you know, for the next 5-6 weeks. We know what we're working with. I'm less concerned with the lineup hitting-wise, just as long as the fill-ins are seeing regular at-bats, playing in regular games. You know what I mean? Experience is the best teacher. And so far, so good. We've seen what these kids have done with short, small sample groups. And, you know, with regularity, I think comes improvement. So I'm actually interested to see, you know, the McKinneys continue and things of that nature. Will they be able to, you know, outlast the competition over, say, the next 10, 15, 20 games? Tough call. We got a lot of games coming up against San Diego. They're suffering injuries as well. We got 2 games against Baltimore. Hopefully we can, you know, fatten up against them. But I'll go back to what Sam was saying. Pitching indeed has been the neutralizing factor, the starters and the bullpen. And if they start to fail, well, that's when the Mets will start to plummet and this conversation changes, particularly, you know, against Luis Rojas. But if the starters, you know, prove their worth and the bullpen proves their worth and collectively they can hold on and perform at an effective level, again, I believe that's the neutralizing factor against opposing teams' lineups and perhaps our shortcomings. But make no mistake, the onus falls on Francisco Lindor and Dominic Smith and Pete Alonso, you know, and they're going to have to carry the load. But rich players do. You look around the league, you look at the division leaders, you look at pennant winners, and you look at world championship winners. Teams are carried by players. It's rare that you see, you know, that collective effort like we saw perhaps in 2015 with the Royals. You know, the more traditional route is when your star and premier players carry the team. And we still have 3 of them in the lineup. You understand? So we have to wait this out. And I'm just pleased that the fill-ins are going to get regular at-bats and play regular games 3, 4, 5 times a week. And we'll be better off for that come September.
May I raise my hand and ask, do we know what's going on with Louis Guillorme?
He's starting a rehab assignment today. He probably already played a game, actually. Syracuse today. So, hey, you know what? That's another piece that can come back. That's not a bad thing, right? But I think you guys hit it on the head. You know, I think you guys absolutely hit the issue on the head. Let's face it. The pitching staff, especially now, is much more healthy than the position players. So you've got, you know, 4 healthy starters. Yes, Peterson's healthy too, but you've got DeGrom back. You've got Walker back. That's huge. The bullpen, thank goodness, is healthy, very deep. So that has kept the team afloat for sure, no question, because the offensive numbers are not good. They're not even average. They're well below league average in most offensive, I think all offensive categories. So,
you know, Rich,
but again,
you brought up some. I'm sorry, Rich, you brought up some pitching numbers before I got a couple of more. You brought up ERA that the Mets were number 2. The Mets have allowed the least amount of hits. They've allowed the least amount of runs. They've walked the least amount of batters. You know, so that must continue. And their WHIP is number 3. And these are all amongst National League competitors. So that has to maintain. I think any dips, you know, we're looking at a precarious fall.
Spot on. And can we just looking at the Guillorme news, it also brings up that Cameron Maben and Wilfredo Tovar were outrighted AAA Syracuse, but one more minor move, the Mets have signed veteran infield Chesler Cuthbert to a minor league contract and assigned him to Syracuse. For the Royals in 87 games in 2019, he had a slash line of .246, .294, .379, .673 with 9 home runs and 40 RBIs.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
They better gas up the bus shuttle to Syracuse.
Yeah. Well, one of the issues that they have is these. So a lot of these guys aren't on the 40. Like Cuthbert's not going to be on. He's not on the 40 right now. And, you know, not as – Maben isn't. And I know, you know, obviously I felt really bad for Maben. But let's say if Almora is supposed to start a rehab assignment soon too, but let's just say he doesn't, something goes wrong there. If you got a couple more injuries to outfielders, you're going to need Maben back. So then you have to make a move on the 40-man roster. And that's one of the things they've been dealing with. You know, they had to send Sean Reed Foley down. Everybody screamed about it. And I like the guy too. And it wasn't a performance thing. He had options left. So, you know, they've had to do a lot of roster manipulations because they're going so deep. You know, you're not going to your 40. You're going deeper than that. And when you do that, guys off your 40. And whether it's – and a couple times they've been able to move people to the 60-day IL, but at the same time, you know, they've had the DFA guys that are getting picked up. And it's tough. You know, it's a tough situation they're in because it's not like they've had a few injuries, key injuries, and you dip down and you get some players. Okay, fine. They're – layer below that, you know, they're below the 40 now. And yes, so good move picking up Cuthbert, this guy they picked up, Blankenhorn. You know, I don't know much about him other than what I've read statistically, but they need bodies right now. They just need bodies in Syracuse to a point where if they have to call somebody up, even if they have to make a 40-man move, they just have to have a human being to bring up. So let's talk a little bit about the guys who are standing. And I think you guys, like I said before, I think you guys hit the nail on the head. The pitching staff is generally healthy and very effective. As long as that can stay in place, the offense can scratch and claw enough to bring out some, you know, score just enough to win. And that's the formula. That's what they're doing. And that's what they're going to have to keep doing until some of these stars come back. Let's talk about Lindor. 391 over his last five games. So I know that's a very small sample size, but it's certainly showing that he's trending in the right direction. And Mike, I'll start with you here. Are you seeing anything in Lindor that you could say, ah, that's why he's looking better at the plate. He's doing that or he's not doing that. And so my question is, what are you seeing from Lindor? And maybe more importantly, do you think this is the beginning of getting the Lindor that we thought we were getting?
First, let me figure out this audio issue. I don't know which screen this is coming from. but you know what? He's trying to be creative, and he's being effective at it. Look, we saw him lay down a bunt the other day. He knows he's struggling. And mentally, he's struggling with being booed. It's never happened to him before in his life. You know, maybe as a visitor in another town, but certainly not as a hometown player. Welcome to New York. That's all I can say to that. But he's trying. In the field, he's not letting, you know, his struggles at the plate interfere with his play in the field. And we see that he engages many players in conversation. And what do we always hear? Communication is key. So I think he's been a very positive influence, and he's having a very positive effect on the team, particularly the infield and the way it's played. And we know he tries to strike a balance between, you know, instincts and analytics. So I appreciate that about him. Hitting-wise, as you say, in the micro, he's improving. In the macro, it's a methodical improvement. You know, he's above the Mendoza line, I think. Just give him time. He's been through this before. I'm not going to let my unscientific personal bias of Central Division players coming east interfere with this. Still going to give him the benefit of the doubt. However, 177 bats, that's a pretty big chunk of your season, you know, and that's going to damage the end-of-season results. And the conversation come October is going to be a little skewed because of it, no matter how well he may or may not finish. So, you know, let's take what's going on so far with a grain of salt. Let's take the season with a grain of salt. Let's hope he gets better acclimated to what he's doing and where he's doing it. And, you know, like Beltran, when he struggled his first season as a Met, his second season we know was one of his premier seasons of his career. Let's hope this is that. Also, Rich, I have to question people's expectations. We're going to bring up the YouTube televised telecast. And on that telecast, one of the announcers, I don't believe it was John Franco, somebody else just flatly called Francisco Lindor a home run hitter as part of conversation. I do not view him as a home run hitter. You see, and this is where I think expectations kind of skew the narrative. Everyone's got different expectations. He's not a home run hitter, Rich. He's a superior defender, and if he gives me 285 to 295 with 25 home runs and 85 to 90 RBIs, I'm thrilled. I know that falls below, you know, his pay, but those are my expectations. And I think if you go and ask the broad spectrum of Metsville, you're going to find that these expectations spike and valley like a cardiogram.
Well, you know, Sam, as I segue to you, I'm going to say something that all right, so looking at Lindor's numbers, right? He's not a home run hitter.
Yeah.
He does hit a good amount of home runs. In 2017, he hit 33, 38 in 2018, 32 in 2019. So, but no, he's not a home run hitter. He's a good baseball player, a good hitter who happens to hit some home runs. I've loved the bunting. And yes, he's not being paid $34 million to bunt, but he knows he's in a slump. He'll do something to try to help the team, which I just love. Sam, as I go to you, I did not read the whole article. There was an article that I saw, maybe you guys saw it yesterday or 2 days ago. The title of it was Francisco Lindor is not in a slump. He's in a 3-year slide.
I think it was just a Twitter graphic.
No, but I think there was an article to it, or maybe not.
Oh, okay.
But really what it said was that the second half of 2019, and I don't have those numbers in front of me, the second half of 2019, he was not himself. In 2020, the shortened season, he only hit 258. And now, you know, he's up to 209, which is actually good, considering where he was. So as I go to comment
the post,
on this, do you think, Sam, that are you at all concerned that we're seeing a trend, or do you think this is just an anomaly and he's going to be fine?
Well, I do want to apologize and correct myself. Yes, it was the Washington Post, which does have, you know, a little skew in the game, if you will. But anyway, I think that when looking at what he's doing now, for one, he's gotten his batting average up considerably to 209. Yes, that's still extremely low. But considering what it was at, I mean, it was – I think it got to like 160-something at some point, 170-something. So he's obviously been coming around and just got his on-base percentage to 300. Yes, that's still too low, as is his slugging at 316. This is where I really want to focus, that we're talking about him not being a home run hitter, but I'm – you know, let me take a look at what his slugging has generally been. Right now, he has an OPS of 617, which, of course, you know, the on-base percentage, you know, considering that he's now gotten it to 300, you know, the slugging is where that really needs to go up. And looking at it, you know, he's generally slugs in the 400 to 500s. And usually, you know, his first season, he slugged 482. His highest, he slugged 519 in 2018. So right now, like we said, 316, I want to see that 3 become a 5. And then we're going to be really cooking with his numbers here. You're starting to see some of that power be produced. I mean, yes, he understands that it's not completely there yet. That's why he's taking the opportunity when it comes. He's been getting some stuff on the ground, and he's also been hitting it pretty – you know, he hit a ground ball that tore up the center fielder or the right fielder, whoever it was, that he was able to get to second the other day. But the ball I'm thinking about in terms of what helped get his slugging to 316 was basically to straightaway center in that deep Arizona cavern of a center field. That ended up, I believe, being a double and was not a home run. If he can start getting that power, jumping on those first pitch fastballs, you know, doing more damage at the plate, regardless of home run, I want to see more extra base hits from Francisco Lindor right now. And you have been seeing it trend that way. And you also see, and you even saw it when he was slumping, that he was a main true leader on this team. That has not wavered, and that's what sucks when people don't see it, when people see it so one-dimensionally and just start booing because they look up and only see a batting average of 180. You have to be paying attention, and you have to look at the inner details of what has made them stay in first place and what has made them continue to win, even though Francisco Lindor has been slumping. He has been a part of that.
I caught that article, Rich. I caught that article, and I could see where that dude was going with it. I mean, if you want to be literal about the numbers, yeah. As I always say, once is an event, twice is a coincidence, three times is a trend. But last year was completely compromised. But I see where he was going with it. I just refuse to buy into it, you know, right now.
Well, a big factor here, Mike, is his age, right? You know, he's not going to be 28 till after the season. He's a young man. And so this isn't somebody, you know, and the Alomar comparisons are ridiculous because Alomar's in his, like, I think he was 34 in the Mets guy, and that's a huge difference between 27 and 34.
And can I also just throw that out there because you mentioned age. I was thinking about how he's only 27, and I looked at the team average, and it's 28.2. You look at it, and there isn't a ball player above 34 years of age here. Even our pitching coach is 33 years old, and both players that are 34, I believe, are on the DL right now. So Jacob DeGrom is the oldest man on this team. This is a very young team, even with the guys that they've been bringing in, you know, basically a reacclimation project.
I believe coming to New York can be more problematic for some people than others. I don't know if this is what's at play here, but I do believe that coming to New York can be a little bit more problematic for some people than others.
That's true. And I think what's surprising people, Mike, is that about that, and it could be, you know, that clearly it might be that he's struggling. He doesn't take the booing well, not that anybody does. But when you saw him before the season and you got to know him a little bit, you know, in the press conferences and such, he doesn't look like the guy who's going to struggle in New York, the personality, the smile, you know, the confidence and all that kind of thing. And I think that's a bit – it's probably surprising a lot of people that if he's the guy who's struggling adjusting to New York, he certainly seemed to be or seemed to carry himself as someone who would take New York by storm, you know, like just put it, you know, put it in his back pocket and love it. And he probably will. He probably is struggling with the acclimation. It's a bit surprising because of who he is personality-wise. So, guys, we're about 15 minutes from game time, so obviously about 15 minutes left in our show. We've talked a lot about, you know, TV and stuff and watching the games on TV. So I want to talk about that. I have two things I want to talk to you about. So, Sam, I'm going to start with you here. I think we have to touch the Bob Brenly thing. It's a big story. Mm-hmm. It was all over the Mets and all over Twitter. We all know what he said. What do you think of that? I mean,
you know, for one thing, I don't think Bob Brenly is an overt racist. However, I you wonder sometimes what goes through some of these old white men's mind before they say things, because it's just like how you don't connect the dots about what you're about to say. Because it's just like, you're just like, basically it has this weird insinuation. It goes all the way back to the idea of separating the sport. Like, we can't forget that part, that this used to be something people thought was okay. And so basically what you're saying is what the undertone of what he's saying is that Marcus Stroman, a black man, can't hold up to Tom Seaver, a white man, who is the greatest pitcher this franchise has ever seen. It was disturbing, to say the least. And I thought that, you know, I kept watching Marcus Stroman out there. And you wonder, of course, like you know, going back to thinking about how news spread with the Wilmer Flores thing with Twitter. So you wonder how quickly these things get around and get to the clubhouse as well. So did Marcus Stroman know about it when he was back out on the mound? Because it was about an inning or two later, he was still on the mound. So, yeah, it was very disturbing, and luckily things are being done about it. And most likely, considering he wasn't fired, he is only taking a few games off, basically the road trip. So Bob Brenly will have something to say to the public on the broadcast, I'm sure.
Mike, what are your thoughts?
Life mimics baseball. Baseball mimics life. It's not the first time. It's not going to be the last time. Pure ignorance on his part to say that. People have got to be more careful. And that's it, you know. Rich, I want to go. I want to say so many things. I really do. But it was wrong to say so much innuendo involved here. It's generational. Some are more ingrained and indoctrinated, knowingly or unknowingly, consciously or subconsciously. And change is slow, and this is more evidence of that. And it's not just his age range, it's everybody's age range. An example of that is a conversation I've had very recently with two individuals, and it centered around the Brooklyn Cyclones going to Coney Island. And the whole conversation was great. It was all about baseball, nothing but. But at some point, somebody said, yeah, but it's tough place to go, man. It's a tough neighborhood. Well, you see, and this was an instance where if you're going to talk baseball, leave it at baseball. But now you're dragging in a lot more and weighing down this conversation with you know, just a maelstrom of things that we can attack and abhor. You know what I mean? Just be more conscious, people. Just stop me, Rich. Stop me.
No, it's fine. I think I would ditto what you said. I think it ditto. And I think we had to bring that up because it is something that was a very big deal Tuesday night and all day Wednesday. And if you follow this team, it's something to talk about. The writers talked about it. And now let's talk about another.
Can I also just real quickly say that, you know, there's a lot of random comments like that don't get the type of viralness like around sports. So, you know, just keep an ear out, people.
Well, I want to throw this at you guys. Let's take New York State drug laws, the Rockefeller laws. They were so strict, but they were made to be that way to deter people from committing those, you know, certain crimes, dealing in narcotics and drugs, etc. They were trying to strike fear into you, saying that if you did this, this is what awaits you. And my point being that, you know, here's a case in point with Bob Brenly. I think that was a rather rough thing to say. You know, sir, if you're the D-back, say, you know what, Bob, we appreciate your work here, but sorry, you need to go. Act with conviction. I'm all for forgiveness. I really am. Let him get a job somewhere else. But as an organization, you have to act with conviction and say, you know what? I'm sorry, but we're drawing the line here. And we're no longer going to tolerate this. Period. That's all you really need to say as an organization. Be on your way. Or stay home the rest of the year. We'll pay you. No problem. But your employment here has just ceased because of that. Whether you're a racist or not, it came out. And you represent us. And that's not the way we want to be represented. And to prove that, here is your termination. Be on your way. That's what's really on my chest.
I hear you. You know, because he said, oh, I'm going to take some sensitivity training.
I don't care what
the
fuck he takes. Bye. Do that on your own time.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, it's like, what the hell is that? I'm going to take some sensitivity training. And I think Disha Kosar put it, she put the quote.
How much more sensitivity training do we need? How many more decades, how many more centuries of sensitivity training do we need? Yesterday or the day before, I'm sorry, I forgot which day it was. I think it was yesterday, marked the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa riots. One of the most devastating racial riots in this country's history. You think they teach that in school? No. You see, so there's a conversation that people are just not willing to have. And I'm not going to bring this podcast down anymore. It's almost game time.
Well, you know, like Disha said when she put his Brimley's quote, where I'm going to take sensitivity training. She said it's interesting that you have to start taking sensitivity training at 67 years old. I mean, and I think that I'll leave it at that too. I think that says it all, right there.
it certainly does.
What earth do you
right? It just ends. You just basically end up blaming the idea of generationalism as opposed to just having common sense. There has to be certainly something to the fact that, like, you know, we let our old grandmas be a little racist occasionally because, well, they're so old. But at the same time, like, yeah, like 67. You know, at some point something's got to give where you just have to think
I think at some point people get stuck. They get stuck in a certain age or a certain year and they don't evolve after that.
That is true. And cool. Guys, we have about six. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Mike.
No, I'm just saying, call it being said in your ways. You could, you know, say that a number of different ways.
We had to hit on it because it's, you know, it's an important thing. And on a different note about TV coverage, as we have about, you know, 6 minutes left here, have to talk about YouTube yesterday. I want to get your thoughts on it. I'll start with mine. The game was on YouTube. I watched some of it on YouTube. I was kind of mad. You know, I was eggy, as they say. I was listening on the radio, listening to Howie, because I'm like, screw this. I want the game to be on SNY. I was yelling at clouds. I was waving my fist at clouds like an angry old man yesterday. and I have to say that when I did put it on YouTube in the bottom of the seventh, when it was a good game, you know, and I wanted to watch it, I thought Franco was good. I thought having Franco and Luis Gonzalez, you know, a former Met, former Diamondback, made sense. I thought the coverage was good. My whole point, though, and I want you guys to comment. I'll start with you, Mike. Okay, you showed on YouTube. Not sure I understand why. I think I do understand why. YouTube probably forked over a shit ton of money to Major League Baseball to cover a couple of games this year exclusively. And okay, fine. To me, if baseball wants to create, and you know, we've talked about this 100 times, they have to reach out to the young people. Yes, I know young people use YouTube, but I don't really think that was the way to do it. I think if they put some short-term money in their pocket, fine. But I really don't think it achieved anything. I'm going to contrast it to what the NFL did in the playoffs last year, where the playoff game was on regular TV, but they did a simulcast on Nickelodeon where, they showed the game, but they did a kid's version of it. Like they had slime and stuff going on.
Yeah,
you know,
great.
Optimus Prime, and they appealed to kids in the kids medium. This was maybe a kids medium, but it was an adult broadcast. So it's like, what in the hell were you doing? But anyway, Mike, talk to me. What do you think of this?
Rich, you know, I'm a caveman. However, I think because I was home and I was at my desk and I have my laptop, I have two laptops in front of me, I was half listening to the game, half not listening to the game. I didn't mind it. I didn't mind one bit, maybe because it was so convenient for me to do at that moment in time. Perhaps had I been somewhere else and I could watch it on my phone, that would have been convenient. But that's not my primary, it's not the primary way I want to go about viewing my Mets baseball. The broadcast itself, I didn't mind. I liked some of the features. I liked some of the different ways they went about their features. Some I could have done without. They need to tweak that. I didn't mind, Rich. I didn't mind at all. I'm not going to say that I liked it. I'm only going to say that I was agreeable with it. And I do think they can do a better job. I know this was an experiment, but I do think they can improve upon it and actually make it a fun product to watch. If they get their, you know, in-between action gig together and tighten that up and give some good, fine quality entertainment, you know. It could be all baseball. It could be graphics, stats, this, that, the other. Incorporate kids, interviews. I don't mind that. I like the I like the Q&As. That was okay. I don't want too much of it. Appeal to kids. Appeal to middle-aged folks. Appeal to senior citizens. We're all baseball fans. That's what makes baseball great. It's a generational thing. That's why it's the national pastime. But even still, it's a pastime. It's not a full contact, you know, rah, rah, rah sport like the others. This is different. No time clock. So tweak it. I didn't mind, Rich. I didn't mind.
Sam.
I wasn't hating on it like so many other people, but it certainly just doesn't have the character that, you know, a lot of, like, basically, back in the day, Gary, Keith, and Ron would have done national stuff. That's just how it worked. The best guys and the most colorful guys did national stuff, and that just doesn't seem, everybody wants to play it safe now. And I like Scott Braun. I don't want to, you know, say that I don't, and I think he does have, he does some Met games occasionally. I think he did some spring games occasionally. But there's something to the dynamic of Howie and Wayne and Gary and Keith and Ron. And what one of the things I have to point out is that I thought that if you are baseball and you are trying to use this to push your sport, I thought they did a great job with the little historical mini documentary of Mike Piazza and the 2001 World Series, and, you know, they covered both the Diamondbacks and the Mets history, and at the same time, they are delivering the history. Like, you know, there's probably some people out there that watched YouTube yesterday that had never heard of Randy Johnson, who had never heard of Mike Piazza, and that is a good thing if they, you know, were informed. It's a good thing that they decided that, I guess, basically, since YouTube's paying for the entire thing and making people draw to YouTube, then ads don't need to be sold. So what do you need to sell? You need to sell the sport. And so I agreed with that element of it. And John Franco, Mike, I loved how you were telling me that at the beginning he was just all Brooklyn about how bad David Peterson was. He's a mess. He's a mess.
that was fresh. I didn't see that, but I heard that.
And Tim, and Rich, since we're about to segue to this game, can I just also say out loud that they just showed Francisco Lindor greeting Tatis Jr. and Manny Machado. And, man, those uniforms look so much better. It was just so nice to see the SNY graphics of the Mets logo and the old Padres logo. They're doing the retro now. they finally figured it out. They finally came together with something that works for them. I like it, and I can't remember the last time. I forget when they did this, these uniforms, but I feel like this is like really the first time that I'm seeing these two teams come together with these uniforms. So bravo. Bravo, Padres.
There we go. First pitch. I know we got different delays, but I got first pitch going on right now, so let's call it a night.
Call it a night, gentlemen, so everybody can focus on the game. Do you want to do a last word? We could do that real quick. So, Mike, first of all, I'm going to ask you two things, Sam, same thing. Mike, where can people find you on Twitter? What work are you doing, and what's your last word?
On Twitter, you can get me at BTB_MikeII. Make it look like a Roman capital, Roman numeral two. You know what I mean. Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. Been spending a lot of time, doing individual Negro League games on this day. Having fun with it. Check me out.
Awesome. Thank you. Sam, where can we find you, and what's your last word?
The_SamMaxwell. Most of the converted Mets fan are just archives now, but definitely check it out. Some fun stuff over there about the New York Metsies. And what else can I say? Enjoy the game, everybody. Let's go Mets.
All right, very good. Gentlemen, we're one batter in, so everybody have a good night. Thanks for listening to the Metsian podcast. Thank you so much to all of our listeners. Have a great night, everybody. Enjoy the game, and let's go Mets. We'll talk to you soon. Take care. Good night now.
Woohoo!
Night, everybody.